Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Thursday, June 30th, and today Tara Palmieri is here to talk about the impact of abortion on the midterm elections. She's been talking to everyone in D.C., everyone in state capitals, about the political opportunities and pitfalls that await both parties this election year. We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Happy Thursday, everybody. I'm joined today by Tara Palmieri in Washington. Are you in New York or Washington, Tara?
Neither, actually. Ooh, okay. Well, New York State.
New York State. You don't have to say where.
Okay. Okay.
No locations.
Where in the world am I? Think of me as Carmen Sandiego.
Perfect. Tara, I want to talk to you about a piece you have up. Your piece is DC Insiders Grapple with the Politics of Roe. I feel like everyone in politics is grappling with the politics of Roe.
Yeah.
But the way you organized your piece was interesting. You basically like categorized the various themes that are coming out of your conversations with Democrats, people on the Hill, people in the White House, Republicans, Republicans in the states. Let's dig in on the Democrats first, though. Like, what are the macro takeaways that the Democrats you're talking to have about this in terms of, can they do anything to fix it in the short term? How will it impact the midterm elections? And also just like, how does some of the language and rhetoric play politically too? I feel like that's an important piece of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the feeling is that it could help some of these frontline districts, the ones that came through on like the suburban swing in 2018, some of these members who came as like a reaction to Trump, right? That was Tom Malinowski in New Jersey, Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, Lane Loria. So there's like a group of these people who came through in a reaction to what was seen as like a rightward bent, right? They're vulnerable because they are kind of in these wealthy suburbs where that also tend to be pretty Republican, but they're not evangelical Republicans, right? And so there's a feeling that this might help them because they're vulnerable, but that's only like a pocket of districts, maybe like 10 or 15. So maybe what some Democrats feared could be like losing by 45 seats could end up being like 30 or even less, 20. But they don't see this being a huge game changer in terms of like motivation and getting people to vote for abortion rights, essentially, over pocketbook issues like the economy. Mm-hmm. So I think the realization is it's not a silver bullet. It's a wild card. It'll help some people. It might staunch the bleeding a little bit. I think one point to make is that 4 months is a long time in politics, right? 4 months ago, Russia invaded Ukraine, hardly top of mind for Americans anymore. A year ago, Biden had a botched pullout from Afghanistan. Like, I think people like noted that in terms of his competence, but I still don't think like when they're going out to vote, they're voting about Afghanistan. Other thinking is that like, it's kind of an uncomfortable topic for a lot of Democrats anyway. The leftists, they tend to go in an extreme. As much as the right is an extreme anti-abortion, the left can also, you know, have their own extremes as well, especially for like white men, Catholics, et cetera. It's not the easiest topic to take on. I mean, they liked it when the messaging was safe, legal, and rare, right? Mm-hmm. That was like a safe space for them. But that messaging is sort of gone now. And I think it makes a lot of Democrats feel uncomfortable because they're afraid if they bring that back, you know, they're going to get hit from the left. And they're going to get hit from the right. So it's just sort of this shitty situation to be on. The House did vote to codify legalization of abortion, but it doesn't really matter because it didn't pass in the Senate. And there's just sort of this like reflection period right now where Democrats are realizing Republicans spent about half of a century working on this, and Democrats didn't spend that time trying to codify it.
I've heard that argument too. I mean, that's certainly a point of view among the young left too. I mean, there was that video that went viral from MSNBC the other day of those two young women outside the court saying, like, why should I give you my money to the DNC? Like, you guys haven't done anything. You know, I talked to a former Obama person the other day about this, and this person said Obama did have 60, he had enough Democrats to like break a filibuster and codify abortion rights at one point. But people forget that, like, Democrats back then, they were pro-life Democrats. You know, they didn't have 60 votes, actually. I mean, like, Arlen Specter was pro-choice on the Republican side, but the 2006 era Democrat, they don't exist really in the party. Mm. This is another thing people forget. Like, Tim Kaine was on the ticket with Hillary while he was still personally, I'm doing quotation marks to Tara on the Zoom here, like, personally pro-life, but publicly pro-choice. And he, as governor of Virginia, passed legislation that restricted abortion rights. And so, yeah, Democrats have had many years to codify Roe v. Wade, I guess, if you just think about them in terms of today's Democrats, who are universally pro-choice. But the party hasn't been like that for 50 years. And that's an important point that's, like, left out of the conversation, some historical context that, sorry, apologies to the kids, but, like, you need to understand that.
Yeah, no, I think that's smart. Democrats have been flat-footed, by the way, on this, I think, in a lot of ways. Like, they've known for about a month and a half that this ruling was most likely to come down. But, like, I haven't sensed any, like, really strong messaging from them.
Yeah, totally. We knew this was happening for a month. You're totally right. The world changed in May when this leaked to Politico.
Yeah.
It's driving the news for 2 or 3 days, kind of subsides, comes back a month later, drives the news for 2 or 3 days. But yeah, like, I don't really know what was happening in the interim. Yes, it would have been nice if Democrats could have codified Roe v. Wade. But, like, the question is, like, they've never had the, like, muscle and the foot soldiers and the grassroots energy around this to match the multi-decade Republican efforts to overturn it.
Right.
You know, and that's what Democrats have been in lacking, especially over the last 10 years.
Right. And now that they do have that grassroots effort, a lot of it is, like, burn it down. And they're kind of, like, hijacking the message and kind of going to extremes, which they're also worried about. And it's like, okay, I think there's a bit of fear in, like, the operative class in DC, where they're like, we haven't figured out what our messaging is on this. And in the meantime, other people have. And that's, like, AOC saying, don't donate to the party. They failed you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they're terrified that, like, this vacuum they've created is being filled with crazies that are going to make it even more difficult for them.
What is the, like, squad lefty message that spooks moderate Democrats? That they think abortion should be, like, on demand at all times and all trimesters?
I think that's part of it. The whole, like, blaming the Democratic Party for it, saying don't donate to Democrats, stifling, you know, turnout, creating the impression that, like, the party doesn't work for them. Like, I think that's part of it. And yeah, I think some of these more extreme views about, like, late term abortions and even just, like, the way people are sort of, like, abortion shaming and stuff like that. I don't know. It's getting, like, a little nasty. But in the meantime, you don't really have any mainstream Democrats with any messaging at all. The White House is like, well, there's not much we can do. I think a lot of it is like, what should we have done? Well, guess what? Like, I had a conversation with a congressman. He's pretty progressive. And I was like, well, what are you going to do? And I don't even think they have the answer to that yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, there's no overnight answer to it. The best they can hope for is, I think, in the short term, is that this rallies their base voters and sort of closes some margins in competitive places. And politics is super homogenized and nationalized at this point. But I've heard a lot of Democrats pointing back to the 2012 Senate election, Missouri, when Todd Akin, the Republican nominee, talked about women getting pregnant from, quote, legitimate rape.
Yeah.
And that totally derailed his campaign against Claire McCaskill. And, you know, Mitt Romney won Missouri by, like, 6 or 7 points, I think. Like, Claire won by 15 points after that. And so, again, that was a presidential election. Turnout was way higher. But the hope from Democrats is, you know, maybe in like, discrete competitive races, like using the Claire McCaskill example, that these fights over reproductive rights can rally enough troops against extremist, quote unquote, Republicans and get them over the hump. So, like, it might be a Republican year nationally, but in certain competitive places, you mentioned Pennsylvania earlier, right, like, maybe this could help narrow the gap. But stick with me. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about how this might play out for Republicans, including in 2024.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back. Tara, you have also in this piece a little ditty about Republicans, in particular, Republicans who might run for president in 2024. Ron DeSantis in Florida,
right,
and Glenn Youngkin in my home state, the Commonwealth of Virginia. You know, will they, now that this is a state by state thing, will they pass abortion restrictions as a way to appeal to the Republican base?
Actually, in the past few days, Youngkin has said that he would support a 15-week abortion ban, which I believe is also the case right now in Florida, or at least they're debating a 15-week abortion ban. And that's something that Ron DeSantis supports. But like, this is not as extreme as the evangelicals like. They want no abortion in any case. And so it'll be interesting to see if these two Republicans who, I mean, you don't win Florida handily as a Republican. We're Democrat. It's weird, but it's not that dissimilar from Virginia in a lot of ways. So it'll be interesting to see, like, especially after DeSantis is reelected, if he ends up going further to the right in hopes of like winning over an evangelical base when he's running for election for president, or does he like try to get a Mike Pence or something on his ticket, like an evangelical type on his ticket? Because like right now, they're not going as extreme as evangelicals would like. And it's interesting that they're not getting a lot of backlash for it either.
Again, this gets to what we were just saying in the first part of this podcast, which is, public opinion on abortion is pretty muddy, and more Americans support than oppose a 15-week abortion ban. Like a first trimester abortion ban is something that actually has a lot of support out there. And a 15-week abortion ban, remember, was like the heart of the Dobbs v. Jackson case that led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And so I think Democrats need to understand a 15-week abortion ban is not seen as draconian by like more Americans than think it is, you know, and that's an interesting POV.
Which is like also brings me back to some thoughts from moderate Dems of like fantasies, obviously, but like in which they're able to codify abortion, Roe v. Wade, but in a way that's like a 15-week, you know, like make it legal across the country at 15 weeks and like allow some sort of compromise. I mean, in the same way that like the gun bill was seen as like insufficient, but it was a bipartisan effort to do some sort of regulation. I think this is a pipe dream, don't get me wrong, but it's an interesting idea to say the least. I mean, I was talking to some like Democratic operatives who were saying, like, best case scenario is like one of these tight Senate races, somebody sticks their foot in their mouth on the Republican side and says something again, like, right? Yeah, exactly, like legitimate rape, and hands it to, like, you know, like Oz says something and Fetterman, it helps Fetterman out, or some Republican is outed for their abortion hypocrisy or this or that. Like, these are, you know, fantasies, but it happens. It happens all the time. And I think it comes back to the whole idea of, like, what are Democrats going to do? And they haven't figured it out yet.
The last thing I want to ask you is the last part of your piece, which is something I really appreciated, actually, because Tara wrote the best focus group. This is the last section of her piece, where you just were upfront about where your mom is at on this. And I actually love that. Like, I feel like sometimes when I talk about, like, the, like, Twitter is not real life thing, like, think political journalists need to get out of the bubble. It's like, you can talk to, like, your grandma or, like, your mom or your friends. And tell me about her politics. It was just a really interesting note to, like, finish out your
piece. Thank you. Yeah, I've always been completely confused by my mother politically because she doesn't vote consistently ever. I mean, she voted for Bush. She voted for Hillary Clinton. Then she decides to vote for Donald Trump. But
this is what a normal voter is like.
I know.
A lot of normal voters are like this. They don't have clean-cut issues.
No.
They vote in some elections, not other elections. Sometimes they forget to vote. Sometimes they show up. Sometimes they vote for Republicans, Democrats.
They're definitely not single-issue voters, and their priorities shift. Yes. So, like, for example, when she voted for Trump again, she said, "I was really surprised to see that my 401k wasn't suffering despite the pandemic." She was like, "I was surprised that I wasn't financially hurting as much as I thought I would be." And that she credited Trump with that. Now, like, did she hate the kids in cages and, like, the way that he acted? Of course. She said, after January 6th, I'll never vote for him again. But she also doesn't want to vote for Biden. So, like, explain that. I was raised in what is Mikey Sherrill's district now. It used to be Republican. Yeah.
She's another frontline 2018 Democrat.
Totally.
Like, moderate, like, not a squad person at all.
Yeah, she's like former Marine or something like that. Then
no, helicopter pilot. She's a helicopter pilot.
Yeah, so she came in that suburban wave in 2018. Like, it was kind of a backlash to Trump. Then my parents moved to Malinowski's district, which is another one. He's up for re-election, a really tight race. He came in reaction to Trump. And so, like, I've sort of kind of always been around these, like, kind of Republican-leaning people, but they're also not Trumpers. And they really care about pocketbook issues. I think maybe it's because New Jersey is such an expensive place to live and the taxes are so high that they really vote based on pocketbook issues. You know, now she lives in North Carolina in McHenry's district. He's basically like a Trumpy guy, or at least he became one. And she was like, I'll be paying attention to what he says on abortion. And I was like, she just wants the status quo.
We know what he's going to say.
I was like, Mom, he thinks it's great. I mean, he thinks the ban is great. And it's like, you know, they just moved to North Carolina. So I'll cut her some slack on that one. But it's just not going to be the first issue, even though she knows, she remembers what it was like when women had to get illegal abortions, and it was dangerous and it wasn't always sanitary, and, like, it's upsetting, but, like, ultimately she's like, am I going to be able to go on vacation this summer? There's the bills are so high. You've got, you know, I don't know. They do say that women over 50 are a huge voting block that no one really quite understands, but have such an impact on so many races and in elections.
Over 50 black ladies decide Democratic primaries. Over 50 white ladies, I would say, and white men in the suburbs, I decide general elections.
Interesting.
That is my observation. You know, the swing voters, like the people in outside of Charlotte, where your mom is, outside of Philly, outside of Milwaukee, they voted for Trump
right
in 2016. And then they voted for Biden in 2020. And bada bing, bada boom, there's your president.
Yet I feel like no one understands these people and or talks to them.
Well, that's the thing. Remember, like, in the Trump era, and, like, reporters would go out and get mocked for, like, spending time with people in diners, like, getting to the Trump voters. Like,
yeah,
the places where you need to go understand swing voters is, like, a goddamn, like, Whole Foods parking lot in, like, suburban Cincinnati. Like, it's not cool. Like, go to, like,
totally.
If there's a Chico's in a strip mall in in, like, a nice suburb.
Chico's.
Like, that's where the election's getting decided. Sorry. That's my advice.
That's not, like, the most quotable thing that I think we've said today. Go to that goddamn Chico's and find out how everyone's voting.
Well, if you listen to the very end of this podcast, that's my advice for political reporters. All right, Tara, enjoy wherever you are in New York. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, and Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13.